questions haunt every life, writes Andy Crouch. The first, what are we meant to be? And the second, why are we so far from what we're meant to be? Hello and welcome to Restoring the Soul, a podcast dedicated to helping you close the gap from what you're meant to be and what keeps you from being all that. I'm your producer, Brian Beatty. Thank you for listening to Restoring the Soul. Heather King has always described herself as an ex-lawyer, a former barfly, and a Catholic convert. Her previous life as a functioning alcoholic led her to numerous illicit relationships that resulted in 3 abortions and a long-term but failed marriage. She is raw and open about her past. On this edition of Restoring the Soul, Michael spends a good part of an hour speaking with our returning guest, Heather King, about her brand new book, Ravished, Notes on Womanhood, that explores parts of her former life and comes to the conclusion that her deepest identity does not lie in our gender, our sexual orientation, our wounds. Our identity lies in Christ. Ravished is also her love letter to the church for bringing her to full flower as a woman and as a human being. As you'll hear in their conversation, Ravished is a book that is as challenging for men as it is for women. Now, to learn more about Heather, visit her blog at heather-king.com. That's heather-king.com. Now, without any further delay, here's your host, Michael John Cusick.
So, Heather King, author, speaker, retreat leader, spiritual director, and modern-day saint, I want to just welcome you back to the Restoring the Soul podcast.
Thank you, Michael.
You had another new book, and we've not been able to connect for a while. The book is a little less than a year old, right?
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh.
And so it's called Ravished, Notes on Womanhood. And I'd like to have you start. This might be a little unusual. Maybe a person would normally read a section of the book further into a conversation. But will you start by reading this preface that kind of sets the tone?
Sure. I'm an ex-gutter drunk who graduated from law school in a blackout, sobered up, quit my job as a Beverly Hills litigation attorney, converted to Catholicism, and in the mid-1990s embarked on the precarious life of a creative writer. My history includes promiscuity, abortions, adultery, a 14-year marriage that ended in divorce, and a lifelong tendency toward romantic obsession. Divorced, childless, single, aging, as a woman in and out of the church, I often feel I have nowhere to lay my head. In and out of the church as well, I'm also often challenged by my fellow women to be angrier. How can you belong to a church that won't allow female priests, for example, is a question I hear often. The short answer is because Christ set it up that way. The long answer is that just because men do something, women should be able to do it, and vice versa, is a notion that strikes me as moronic. I want to glorify womanhood, not water it down. Any woman who wants to be a priest for the right reasons, which is to die to self, to serve, will already have naturally ordered her life so as to be acting in a priestly capacity. My failure at romance is the part of my story that tends to make me feel most ashamed, humiliated, exiled, and like a loser. It touches upon my fear that I'm not worthy of love, nor capable of loving others. It goes to the heart of my womanhood and my humanity. To accept this reality, to have come to see my situation even as a strange grace, has been a long, painful crucifixion. But to have suffered the wound these last 3 decades without anesthesia has formed in me, at last, something useful, something eternal. Here's what I've learned. Our deepest identity does not lie in our gender, our sexual orientation, our wounds. Our identity lies in Christ.
Thank you. That is beautiful. So right away, listeners will know that your writing is incredibly vulnerable and tender and raw because that's how your life and story have been. but also that you just have this gut level honesty of telling it like it is. And even as you read that part, Heather, it sets up this tension in the book that you wrote the book about notes on womanhood, and womanhood is part of one's identity, and yet you're saying that there's something bigger than that that's part of our identity. But can we start with, back at the beginning of what you read, that women often challenge you to be angrier? And there's a lot of ways where you've been angry at the right things in right ways, and a lot of ways where you've not been angry when you've been challenged to. So tell us about that.
Well, I think we live in a culture that is sort of the overarching feeling is that we're somehow put upon, that we're being discriminated against, that we need to rise up. And I always feel like we live in the United States of America, went to college, I went to law school. Most of the people I know are fairly well educated, fairly well off. I mean, what are we, I just don't understand the anger, and I'm very resistant, to sort of adopting that low level hostility, and to me sort of whining as a sort of philosophy. I think our anger should be a little bit more on behalf of people who, I can only speak for myself, on behalf of people who have way, way, way less than I do, who are sincerely discriminated against. And I just don't feel that's me. Most all of the misery in my own life has been caused by my own, by my actions, by my decisions. And again, I feel culturally, we live in a culture that is so anti-taking responsibility for ourselves. It's all about blaming someone else. I just found that doesn't work to give me any kind of inner freedom.
And you make a very clear point all throughout the book, but you explicitly state that you're appalled by discrimination and violence and oppression over and against women, but that you also say in the very next paragraph that women need to look at how they contribute to their own objectification. And that is a really perilous and politically incorrect thing to say, which is one of the things I love about this book, is that you're a champion for women without watering that down to having to be a homeschool mom or Laura Ingalls on Little House on the Prairie, which actually is a very strong picture of a woman. But you say some things that are really out there. So can you, as a woman, speak to that?
Well, yeah. And I mean, first of all, I love that womanhood has an infinite number of sort of iterations. I mean, I'm very clear on, I do believe womanhood, I mean, motherhood is just this kind of crowning glory of being a woman. It's one major way we're different than men. We're able to bear new life into the world. And so let's celebrate that. And we're formed psychically, physically, emotionally, spiritually around that. It doesn't mean being a mother, a literal biological mother, is the only way of being in the world and of laying down our lives for our friends. I've been single and celibate for 20 years. I think if we really love our fellow women, first of all, that means we also really love our fellow men, because you can't, love doesn't confine itself to one gender or one little compartment. So in other words, if I love all of humanity and my heart is bleeding over the suffering of humanity, I'm called to examine my own actions and life down to the smallest detail, and to see how those actions contribute possibly either to the suffering of the world. I think our actions are either toward life or toward death. And because of my very bad track record in the sex department when I was out there drinking, I had abortions before I came into the church. And those wounds of guilt, of loneliness, of realizing I had really, that those kinds of actions really contribute to the oppression and discrimination against women the world over. If I want to support my fellow women, I get to look at all my actions, how I earn my living, how I spend my time, how I spend my money, the inner orientation of my heart. And this is the thing we really don't want to look at our own sexual behavior. Because that, I think, as a friend of mine, Rita, in the book, there's an interview with my friend Rita Simmons, and she makes the point that our culture doesn't really welcome children. It's a contraceptive society. It's a society that's about control. And I think we can see how that has spun out from the 60s to a really sort of almost science fiction, total dissolution of the human identity, of even a hatred of or a refusal to acknowledge that men and women are fundamentally different. And there's a huge reason we have our own functions in the world. And when you start taking those away, it leads to suffering that is way beyond what's been imposed by the patriarchy.
I don't want to try to categorize you because I don't like when people try to categorize me, but you are theologically Roman Catholic and subscribe as a woman in the church to the Catholic Church and its teachings. And yet you embrace this Dorothy Day, oftentimes considered liberal, social justice. You know, you have lived among the homeless, you have been in recovery. And so there's these two parts of you that seem very much in contradiction, at least the way that the culture understands that, right? You should fit into one camp or the other. And you're saying, I want to glorify womanhood, and yet you're saying things that from the secular perspective seem to be diminishing womanhood. So do you recognize that tension yourself, and how do you live in that middle space?
No, that particular tension, Dorothy Day is Catholicism. I mean, one facet of it, one room in our Father's mansion. There's absolutely no conflict in my mind between being, she to me is in fact a wonderful example of a woman who was absolutely orthodox in her belief and in her actions, but didn't wait for approval from men in particular. She went, she had a vocation, and she followed it completely. So I don't feel any tension whatsoever between Catholicism and being a lover of Dorothy Day. She's up for canonization, to the church's credit. I don't feel that particular tension. I do. Listen, I'm a convert. I came into the church in 1996, and it took me years. I came in through reading the Gospels. You know, I really came in the old school way, like through being a massive sinner and sort of coming as a prodigal daughter. I read the Gospels while I was working as a lawyer in Beverly Hills, and my eyes were opened. I mean, literally, I said, oh, this is the way, the truth, and the life. And it took me years after that, because I don't read a lot of, to this day, I don't pay attention to sort of virulent arguments within the church and the haters and the Pope haters and the right wing and the left wing. I just don't read any of that. It doesn't interest me. And therefore, I feel like I've always just kind of, I don't even want to say gone my own way, because I'm an utterly by the book Catholic. I buy it all from the beginning. There's nothing in the teachings of Christ and in the what we're called to out of obedience to the teachings of the church. None of that remotely grates on my conscience. It completely comports with my conscience. So I don't feel that kind of tension. However, because of that, in a way, because I'm not in any particular kind of ideological camp, you know, I feel a little bit in exile, because people want to fit you into a camp to see if they can like you or not, or accept you. But with all that, I've gone my own way. Look, the church has found a place for me. I write for Angelus News. It's the archdiocesan newspaper of the biggest archdiocese in the country. I write for Magnificat, probably the Catholic magazine with the widest circulation in the world. So the church has found a place for me, and I have not had to market an ideological stance as a Catholic, which just absolutely makes my skin crawl to think of doing that.
Well, and that's what I mean by that you live in a tension. You said it better than I did, that you've not landed in an ideological spot except for Christ, and that Christ invites you, and I believe invites I, to go back and forth wherever we're required to show up in that kind of incarnational, embodied way. Would you agree to that?
Yes. Yes. And I think that's sort of St. Therese of Lisieux, for instance, who is also a deep companion. And Dorothy Day loved St. Therese, who, for people who don't know, was this cloistered, seemingly the diametric opposite of Dorothy Day. She was a cloistered Carmelite nun from a bourgeois French family, cloistered, very sort of outwardly somewhat pious, but had a deep, deep spirituality, has been in fact made a doctor of the church, one of only, I think, four women. And her spirituality was, just as you say, as followers, as Catholics, we're followers of Christ. We have a love affair with him. That's our job. Mother Teresa said the same thing. People think our work is working with the poor. Our work is to love Christ. And so I think if we stay there, it's the place of the most freedom and the deepest creativity, and the place where you're actually most likely to be able to be sort of, I don't even want to say fiercely independent, but just to go your own way in obedience, knowing because you're held fast by this beautiful framework of the teachings and the church.
I want to give a shout out for listeners that are not familiar with your other works, that speaking of St. Therese, you've written a book called A Shirt Aflame, which is a combination part memoir on your part and part biography of her. And that's a powerful book.
Thank you. Yeah. And people love, I think part of St. Therese's greatness, or the proof of it, is that a wide, hugely wide variety of people are attracted to her. People you might not think would be, like, for instance, social activists or guys in prison, or, I mean, all different types. So, she's been a wonderful companion.
And died at the young age of 24, and yet she's been one of the most widely read Catholic saints of all time.
Yes, and she, even though you look at her from the outside and she's got the little habit and she's in the cloister and she's in this obscure convent in France, but when you read her writing, she burned, speaking of being a priest, she said, I want to be a priest, sort of small p. She didn't want to be a ordained priest, but a priest to act in a priestly capacity, as a bridge, as a shepherd. She wanted to be a priest, a martyr, a missionary. And she knew that, and a saint, and she somehow had total faith that that would come to be, even though she never left that cloister and died, as you said, at a very young age. And in fact, she is a priest, quote unquote, a martyr, a saint, a missionary. So I think our fierceness comes in our insistence upon letting our flame, our passion, burn as brightly as it can. And that doesn't mean you walk around with sweat above your upper lip or with a megaphone. It burns inside, and it's always leads to some kind of excruciating death ongoing of all kinds of things, your hopes, your plans, your idea of how you're going to be happy. But that is the journey, I think.
I love how St. Therese went to her priest. She wanted to go into the convent at age 15. No. Then she went to her bishop, basically, and the answer was no. So she said, Dad, take me to Rome. And she had an audience with the Pope. And talk about fierceness and determination of not being denied.
Yes, that's a wonderful story. And en route, by the way, because they were pilgrims, and they met all these priests on the way who were also going to Rome. And she's first kind of her... She encapsulated all sort of criticism of priests for all time with a very short statement that, oh, I saw then that priests are fragile, I'm paraphrasing. They need a lot of help, and I determined from that moment on to pray for them always. And how beautiful is that? It's like if you want to, you know, that's another way of being a priest. But yeah, and then she went to the Pope and against the strict orders of the Papal Guard to not touch the Pope. Like all you're supposed to do is like kneel and kiss his ring. And she knelt at his feet and grasped his knees and said, please, Holy Father, if it be thy will, please let me enter the convent. She used her charm too, I think. You know, she was fully aware. She was very attractive and a charming 15-year-old girl. And she used that not to seduce some rich guy, but to enter into her own sort of agony and crucifixion in a way, like, please let me in. And lo and behold, somehow it happened, as the French say, woman's will, God's will. And she entered the convent at 15.
Well, I wasn't planning on talking about her as it relates to your book, although you mention her even in this volume, Ravished. But I think that is a picture of, as you described her there in the Vatican, of fierceness and intentionality with that feminine charm and innocence and tenderness, that those two are not often seen side by side. And there again is a tension that you call readers to in the book. And I told you this at the top of the podcast before I hit record, that I think this book is as powerful for men as it is for women, and it's challenging for both. But can you speak more about that fierceness and the tenderness, the traditional, if I put it in quotes, femininity, and then the fierce side that mm-hmm. women are often attacked or accused of being a bitch when they're that way?
Oh, yeah, and there's all kinds of tensions in there. There's, if I'm going to be a follower of Christ, I should walk around looking dowdy, for example. And Carol Houselander, the wonderful spiritual writer, British, who some of your listeners may know, she made the point that doesn't, being dowdy doesn't do, give glory to God. I mean, everyone loves a nice-looking woman, so I think we totally are called to, you look as well as you can without, you know, you don't have to dress like a sex worker, but I mean, you know, why not? We're called to have, I don't know, just sort of a healthy sense of self-esteem. So there's that kind of thing. There's, but as far as what I have found is, listen, in my former, when I was drinking, I mean, I was constantly looking for a guy, you know, to sort of complete me, to be the one. And therefore I was, I wasn't a very good manipulator either, which was always, I always admire the women who are like, you know, could really make that work for them. I never really could. But anyway, I tried really hard. And so there's, the point is, there's a natural, you're giving all the power to the man when you're in this kind of supplicant position. And I have found, and you're sort of inviting the world to treat you less than your value, because I was putting myself forth as having less value than I really do. And so my point is, since I've gotten sober and then about 8 years later came into the church and just embarked on this lifelong halting, lurching journey of kind of becoming a responsible adult and as free as possible from the bondage of self, what I find is that people naturally treat me with respect. Like, I have not had a guy, and if anybody makes any kind of sort of come on, I mean, it's like, no. That is cut, that is nipped in the bud. Not in a rude way, but it is nipped in the bud. We're not going there. But that's not, you know, to be bitchy about it, but it's just, we're not going there. And that, but then there's, you know, I have been in I was a lawyer, and now I've been in publishing, which is also a very male-dominated world. And so there's many, many times when, and the Catholic publishing world in particular is not known for its munificence, let's say. So there's lots of times when I've been called to sort of negotiate a contract or ask for a raise or in front of people who are in a position of way more power than I have. I mean, the writer always to me makes the most contribution, has the least amount of power. And you just have to get your mind around that and accept it. And okay, I'm not going to be resentful about this. That's the way it is. How can I conduct myself with integrity? But that has taken a lot of, you know, just stand your ground. Sometimes you ask for a raise, the answer is no. Okay. All right. Thank you. You know, and it's my on me. If I want to quit and try to find something better, great. But I can't be resentful and whiny. I asked, they said no. Or you negotiate as best you can. And it's always, I don't like conflict. I'm a kind of a people pleaser. I don't, you know, that none of that is my favorite thing. But you learn to do it because out of obedience to the vocation itself, the vocation of writing. And I'm accountable in the final analysis, well, in every analysis, to Christ. I have to make a living, you know, a decent living where I'm not sort of schlepping around like a ragamuffin. But everything, when we're ordered to Christ, everything sort of falls into place. Listen, I've made my way. I have hitchhiked across country by myself. My parents helped, but I mean, I went through law school in like the throes of acute alcoholism, graduated with honors. At the age of 40, I moved to LA, and after being a waitress all my life, became a lawyer. I mean, I was like scared out of my wits. I have been through divorce. I've been through cancer. I became a Catholic writer in a literary world where even to believe in God is like career suicide. So I have, and now I've made, you know, I don't have a spouse. I don't have a cheerleader. I don't have like that. It's like, I am very well aware of how, of my value and of the integrity that it has taken and that sort of perseverance to continue in what I believe is my vocation. So I don't need to impose myself and throw my weight around. Like, and I don't also have to feel sorry for myself or put upon by the patriarchy. It's like, go your own way, patriarchy or not. It's like, don't wait for, if you're so fierce, go do your thing. Who cares? You know? Well, and with all that, I love men, as you know from the book. We love men. So there right. You go.
Well, and so I may be just like a pit bull not wanting to let this go, because I actually think you do such a wonderful job of unpacking it. But you, on the one side, talk about how you're not a victim to certain systems like being a woman in a male-dominated literary world or being in the law firm or in the law practice. And you also, through all of your writing, you talk about how one of your core beliefs is to live in and be real about your spiritual poverty. So on the one hand, it's a sense of powerlessness. And on the other sense, it's a sense of being empowered. And both of those are very real. How do you navigate that? And then what do you say to the woman who says, but I was in the law firm and in the literary world, and I never could go forward. I never could go up the ladder. Maybe it was because they were bad at the law, or maybe it was because they were a woman.
Okay, well, those are two different questions. And the first one is, I will just say, I mean, victimhood is a very different thing than spiritual poverty. I think we're all poor in spirit when you get right down to it. And this, that's why Christ said, blessed are you. I mean, I think... Listen, and it's not to say, of course, there's like massive discrimination in all male-dominated fields. But my point is not to, that I refuse to let that define me. And so you find ways to work around it. That's what it is to be a free, creative, strong, quote unquote, individual. And as for the women who have wanted to work their way up and can't, it's hard for me to speak to that because I was a lawyer and this is not a put down of the legal field in any way. And there are martyrs and incredibly incredible people. But it wasn't my vocation. And so it's hard for me to imagine that someone would want to, go up the ladder. That's a tough one. I think though the spiritual principle is you give everything you have to whatever your desire may be. If your desire is to go up to the ladder to get more money and property and prestige, again, I can't really, that's fine, but I think if that's our deepest desire, then we're sort of cutting ourselves short. And maybe if we don't get that, it's a blessing in disguise to sort of invite us to something else. If you're a lawyer for the right reasons, it seems to me, which again, it would be to serve people. I would imagine you could do that no matter how much money or how little money you were making.
And would you say that would be true for a man as well, or is it different?
As far as
that if you're trying to go up the ladder and become a partner. Okay.
Yeah. Those are spiritual principles that go across the board for every human being on earth. I'm sure it's in many cases easier for a guy to work his way up the ladder to money, property, and prestige.
So this may be really obvious and you can just go, duh, Michael, and I won't be offended. That back to that very first part of our conversation, that whether we're talking about womanhood or manhood, that if we don't talk about an identity that transcends both of those, which is in Christ, we will get bogged down in the cultural, social expectations of what that is.
Well, and not only the social and cultural expectations at this point, but literally the sort of engineering out of the gender that you were, quote, assigned, as it's called, at birth. It's to me this blurring of the, it doesn't matter, men and women are the same. They're of equal value and there's nothing different about them. It's all a cultural construct. And that to me is just, it just absolutely does not comport, number one, with my experience as a human being and as a woman. And two, it's just to me sort of demonic. Why would you not? Even if you go to the back to the idea of story, look how the Bible begins, right? Man and woman in the Garden of Eden. It's like if you don't have man and woman, there's a certain dramatic tension there. There's something at stake. There's a risk involved, partly because when they get together, there is the possibility of new life. It's just perilous in the best possible way. And I think even if you want to confine the discussion to that, the whole idea of story, it's to me to do away with God, number one, and then to do away with the notion of man and woman as being utterly different creatures who are fatally and beautifully attracted to each other. And because our identity lies in Christ, it's like a basic tenet. We're born in his image a certain way, with possibly a certain sexual orientation, with all kinds of stuff. But that's how we were made. And how can I accept that, not try to manipulate it and mutilate it and deny it and change it? But how can I accept that? And it's often a massive cross. We all have the cross of being a human being, but say to have same-sex orientation. It's a huge, if you're going to follow the teachings of the church, yes, it's a cross because it means celibacy. But celibacy is not the end of life. I mean, I'm a prime example of it. And I think if we're called again, you begin to see how the church invites us all, whatever our station. The church is the only place, I say this in the book, that I, as a aging, single, childless, spouseless woman, the church is the place where I am really of equal value with everyone else. The culture sees me as a throwaway person.
And so, you said before that how could anyone say that the church doesn't or didn't love and honor women? And there would be some people that hear that and would do a spit take, but your experience has been very different. And you also look at Jesus and the Gospels and unpack that. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I mean, Christ loved women. There's any number of parables in the Gospel, from the woman at the well to Mary Magdalene washing his feet with her hair, to the hemorrhaging woman, to he loved women. I think he really got women. He got our hearts. He got the shortcuts that we will take to sort of get what our hearts long for or try to get it. And he said, come to the living water. I mean, on the stations of the cross, the eighth station, the last station before he falls for the third time and is stripped of his garments, eighth station, Jesus speaks to the women. We were the last people he spoke to before he went to the cross. To me, part of what that indicates is, women, I am depending on you. You know, you are the long sufferers. You're the ones who hold things together. You're all about relationship. You're about patient endurance. You have a sense of humor. You are fierce. We need you desperately. And stay with me. So there's that. I mean, and then there's the incredible devotion to Mary, his mother, who, I mean, again, how can you look? I mean, he crowned her queen of heaven and earth. Mary is revered in the Catholic Church. Yeah, so Mary to me is just, listen, she watched her. This, again, is no pious. It goes back to the, how do we resolve the tension between the sort of pious image of woman and the sort of independence and freedom and strength. Mary is the perfect, the emblem of that. I mean, she has this son her whole life. Her heart, she ponders these things in her heart. She knows from the beginning, this is this incredibly special child that you've been invited to bear into the world. She says yes, and she's puzzled by him. The kid wanders off on the way home from Jerusalem, and they're frantic. Where is he? Oh, didn't you know I had to be about my father's business? She underwent, in other words, all the tension and anxiety of being a mother, and then she watched him in the prime of his life, tortured to death, stood at the foot of the cross, and then continued living. We don't see Mary after the crucifixion, but like ponder that of Mary was called to live, I guess, as far as we can figure, several more years bearing that wound on the cross. He says to his beloved disciple, John, behold your mother, behold your son. So she lost her own son and then is kind of given a foster son. But just everything that is incredible about women, that ability to stand firm in the face of just unspeakable suffering and to bear joy and more light and more life into the world. Yeah. Now, I'm sure the church, again, I'm not involved in parish life. I have had no, I'm not like a hierarchy type. I don't sort of curry favor or especially want to be involved in the sort of power portion of the church. So therefore, I'm sure if I did, I would come up against all the stuff that people complain about. But the church doesn't have a corner on treating women or not paying them enough money or treating them bad. I mean, that's not an excuse, but it also, that's like the bureaucratic arm. That doesn't in any way detract from the church itself and of Christ and of his teachings. So that would not, that kind of stuff would not dissuade me from my follow, being a follower of Christ any more than like the priest scandals did. I mean, none of that detracts from the beauty and the truth and the goodness of the teaching and of Christ himself.
Thank you for sharing about Mary. I think a lot of our listeners who are from a Protestant tradition or anything outside of Catholicism, and even non-believing folks, that the idea of Mary is often a caricature or just written off as she's a character in the Bible and Catholics worship her, which of course is not true. But what a beautiful, beautiful picture of womanhood. And I think what a beautiful picture of that aspect of God, though he is Father, that it says in Genesis chapter 1 that he let us make them in our image. So male and female, he created them. So God has feminine aspects and masculine aspects. And it's only when those two are joined together that the image of God can be more fully seen. And recently, the solemnity of the Annunciation happened when the angel Gabriel came and announced 9 months before Christmas that she would be with child. And that took me to a place of going back to those scripture passages and really, for the very first time, pondering that. And as you just spoke of this, I just had this wave of emotion come over me. What worse suffering, not just to be a mother, to watch your child executed, but that she's the only person, the only human being that spent 33 years with this God-man, Jesus, then watch him being executed, but also to watch God be executed. Just horrific. Mm-hmm. And it's just beautiful. I want to end with this, Heather. You wrote in the same preface that you quoted at the beginning that you wanted to show what a real feminist and a real warrior woman would look like. And you've been talking about it all along, but can you just say in a sentence or 10, what does it look like for a woman to be a real warrior and a real feminist and to be a follower of Christ?
Well, I hope I didn't purport to call myself like a warrior, like a real warrior or a real feminist. I mean, it sort of goes to, well, we're just in the week after Easter, and I think it goes so much to the resurrection and the very interesting fact that Christ's own disciples didn't recognize him after the resurrection. I'll just keep it on me. You know, I think we want a cataclysmic, a sort of lording it over, a conflagration. Aha, I have vanquished, I am victorious. And that's not the way Christ's resurrection. I mean, I think real sort of enlightenment, whatever you want to call it, real being a real, quote, warrior, a real lover of your fellow women, that's what a feminist means to me. It's something, again, that is not worn on your sleeve. It's not bandied about on a banner. It's lived in a hidden, invisible, unproclaimed way to the absolute hilt every second of your day. I mean, it's something, it means developing a deep prayer life of learning to do without a lot of validation, usually a lot of without being recognized, with being misunderstood. Yeah, I think we're all called, I hope it's okay to say this. I mean, I thought during this pandemic, what if the entire, you know, we've had all these rosaries and I was like, what if everyone in the world stopped watching porn for like an hour? Like, I bet the whole, like, seriously, I bet like a ton of COVID-19 cells would die. In other words, I use that example because it goes to how deeply do you really care about your fellow woman and your fellow man? Am I willing to offer literally my body and blood according to my station in life? Which, listen, you're either married or you're single. If you're married, that's its own crucible. You offer your body and blood to your spouse and your family, or to the world through your spouse and family. If you're single, as a Catholic, you're celibate. You offer your body and blood that way. But to be faithful in that way, to be chaste in body, mind, spirit. I mean, come on, this is an ideal. We fall short every second, but I think that's what it means. And Christ said, narrow is the gate. So you never quite reach it either, but you know, we're called to love one another as he loved us. That's the bottom line. And man, that is the goal of a warrior. I only wish to be worthy of it one day.
Heather, thank you. That's a great answer. And I'm going to encourage people to pick up a copy of this book. I love this tension. It seems to me like a whole book of tensions. And I really am thankful for you to banter with me and to field these questions that really are not out of me being contentious, but out of me being curious.
Yeah, no, they're great questions. Yeah.
Especially as a man, because there's not a lot of formats where you can sit down and have these kinds of conversations where it's not just one-sided or the other. So I also want to thank you for all the writing you do and for the ways that you bring your story and your life and the redemption into the world for people to experience through your books.
Thank you, Michael.
So we've wrapped up another episode of Restoring the Soul. We want you to know that Restoring the Soul is so much more than a podcast. In fact, the heart of what we have done for nearly 20 years is intensive counseling. When you can't wait months or years to get out of the rut you're in, our intensive counseling programs in Colorado allow you to experience deep change in half-day blocks over 2 weeks. To learn more, visit RestoringTheSoul.com. That's RestoringTheSoul.com.
You already know we live in a pornified world, but most of us are at a loss for how to navigate this sea of temptation. It's either ceaseless striving on the one hand or giving in to brokenness on the other. But doesn't the gospel offer us another way? The truth is that our sexual struggles are not actually about sex, but about a misdirected, God-given longing for deep connection. Dig deeper in my book, Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle.